This is Digital Story Podcast number 973, November 12, 2024. Today's theme is Tips for Showing Your Pictures on a 4K TV. I'm Derek Story. Family gatherings, special occasions, wedding receptions, and photography workshops. These are all great opportunities to show your pictures on a big screen. But how do you set things up so they look as good as possible? I have a few tips for you, and I'm going to share them on today's TDS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. On the final day of our photography workshops, we gather around a big 4K TV and share a handful of pictures from the week. This is always a highlight of the event for me, and I think it's the same for each photographer. Over the years, I've used and experimented with different systems for a large screen display. In the early days, I used an Epson projector with a screen. At the time, it didn't seem too terrible, but I do remember turning around my laptop and showing the audience its display so they could see what the picture really looked like. That's not a good sign when you have to do that. And by today's standards, this method just isn't good enough. Now we have big 4K LCD screens with HDMI output. And depending on the brand and the model, these can be quite good. They're still not as excellent as our laptop screens or dedicated computer monitors, but with a little tweaking, the results can be quite pleasing. So I thought what I'd do is share some tips for making this happen, because if you think about it, there are occasions all the time where this could be useful. I mean, it could be as simple as just coming back from a vacation, a family vacation, and you want to share the pictures with everyone. And there's no need to huddle around a little computer screen to do this, right? You can go into the living room, everyone can put their feet up on the couch, and you can show the pictures on a big LCD screen. And that's a lot more fun. It is, in that instance, the modern day slideshow, right? When we used to come back from vacation and then we'd get all the film processed and we'd have all the slides, and then we'd pick out the ones that we want and we put them in a slide carousel. And then we'd invite as many people as we could talk into coming over so we could show them our adventures on a projected big screen. Well, this is a lot easier and, quite honestly, a lot prettier, because we can do the work first on our laptops, right? We can, you know, figure out what shots we want. We can fine tune them, add a little color, do a little tonal adjustment, all that good stuff. Put them in a virtual collection or put them in an album in the order that we want. And then all we have to do is plug our device, whatever it happens to be. I mean, this could be your smartphone. This could be your tablet. This could be your computer. I'm going to talk about all the different ways that you can connect it to an LCD TV. Anyway, we take whatever device we have, plug it into the TV, and then on a nice big screen, we all can sit back and enjoy it. And this is also fantastic for wedding receptions. If you want to put together a slideshow, a rotating slideshow of, let's say, the bride and groom, over the years before they met each other, and then after they met each other, and some dating photos and some engagement shots and all that good stuff. And if you have a photographer that's really working overtime, you can even squeeze a few shots in from the ceremony and have them dropped into that show at the reception. So, weddings are another great time. Family anniversaries, the holidays, great fun. And this doesn't have to be something that where everyone sits down and has to watch. This can be something, let's say you're having a holiday gathering this year. This can be something that you set up on the TV and just have it rotating. Just have it, going through, let's say that you have 80 or 100 shots in there, you know, from previous holidays and family shots and family events. And you just set it up. And that could be a nice thing to have, you know, running in the background, or when people sit down to talk, you know, these slides are running, and it could even become a conversation piece. So there's lots of opportunities to show these things. I really like it for the workshops. And, you know, one thing about doing it for the workshops that I have really appreciated is that I'm showing these shots to photographers. So, and it's their shots, right? So we're sharing these shots at the end of the workshop. So their shots up on the screen, they know exactly how they're supposed to look. So I have to get as close to that as I can. This is what I call a discerning audience. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about how we do that. Now, it can be as simple as making an HDMI connection. And this is what I do more often than not, especially for our workshops on the road, because all I have to do is find the best LCD TV that I can. They always have HDMI output. Now, usually one of those outputs is being occupied by a cable box or, you know, whatever the hotel or Airbnb is using, but there's almost always a spare HDMI output that we can use. So in this case, all I have to do is bring a cable, a nice 6 foot or longer cable. And my MacBook Pro, I intentionally got a MacBook Pro that has the built-in HDMI output, so I don't have to get an adapter or anything. However, if you don't have one that has built-in HDMI, it's easy enough to get a USB-C adapter for it. And I plug one cable into the TV, plug the other cable into the laptop, and then you have to have the TV remote, right? Because TVs these days don't allow you to make adjustments to the TV on the TV itself. That would be just too easy, wouldn't it? So you have to find the remote and then go to input on the remote. All the remotes will have some sort of input button. And you click on input on the remote, and then you'll cycle through the HDMI outputs that the TV has, and you cycle to the one that's connected to your laptop, and then voila, it should just work. Because laptops these days are very good at recognizing, you know, the device they're hooked to, and then adjusting the resolution so that it works both on your laptop screen and on the TV itself. Now, when we do our presentations, I'm using the laptop screen as I'm, you know, setting up and cycling through. I run the shows, and then each participant talks when their picture comes up on the screen. And then the audience is able to see what's going on the 4K TV set. They mirror each other. And that's what you want to pick when you're setting up these displays. So you have HDMI talking to HDMI, and then you go to mirroring, and then the computer and the TV should work things out. And like I said, the laptops we have today are very good at figuring out the 4K LCD, and they will give you a good resolution for both. It's really fantastic. So that's my favorite way to do. Why do I like it better that way? Well, because there are fewer things to go wrong. And especially when I'm in charge, whether it's a workshop or anything else, the fewer things that I have that could possibly go wrong, usually the happier I am. And in this case, all I have is one HDMI cable to connect the two devices. So that's about as easy as it gets. There are other ways to do this as well. You can do it wirelessly. And there are advantages to a wireless connection. One is you don't have to be within the length of the cable to the TV. So, which sometimes can be a problem. You know, I've even run into that at workshops on the road where I'm trying to find a spot where I can sit and set up the laptop, but still have enough cable length to reach the TV. If you're wireless, you don't have to worry about that. You can be sitting anywhere in the room and having the laptop send the pictures to the TV over the Wi-Fi network. That is a big advantage. The other advantage is, especially if you're doing something like AirPlay, which is what I use, other people can be sharing their images as well. I generally have everyone give their images to me. I organize them and then present them. But if you wanted to be in a more dynamic situation, especially if other folks had iPhones and iPads and stuff, and you're using Apple TV for your device, then you could send some images up, and then you could, you know, turn off mirroring, and then they could send some images up. So other people in the room could be sharing images straight from their devices. So if that's a situation that you want, wirelessly is a lot easier than you getting up, unplugging your laptop, and having someone else try to connect their device to an HDMI cable. So there are a couple of advantages. However, there are some disadvantages as well, and you may have run into these yourself. One is you need some sort of device, streaming device, to make this all work. In my case, because I'm in the Apple environment, I have an Apple TV that I can take on the road. And it's not too big, right? It's just a little hockey puck, and you need to remember the power cord, and you still need an HDMI cable, right? Because that's the way, in this case, the Apple TV is connected to the regular TV through HDMI. It's just that now you can talk to the Apple TV wirelessly. So you need to remember those things. The other thing that you need, obviously, is a Wi-Fi network that's open, right? Because the Apple TV has to log into that network, and you can do that through the settings once you connect it. And then you log your laptop or other device onto that same Wi-Fi network, and then your device can see the Apple TV streamer once you're both on the same network. So you need to have that going for you too. So you can see how this can be a bit more complicated. Now, the other thing that happens is that all the devices, let's say you're in the Apple ecosystem on this, all the devices sort of connect to the Apple TV differently. On my MacBook Pro, I just go up to the control panel icon that's on the very top menu bar. I tap on it, and there's a little square in that control panel for screen mirroring. And so I tap on that, and if the Apple TV streamer is on and running, then my MacBook will see that, and then I can connect to it that way. So that's through the control panel on the MacBook Pro. Now on the iPhone, it can vary with the different iOSs that you're using. The way that I like to do it is I use Photos, the Photos app. So I put the pictures that I want to use in an album, and the Photos app makes it easy to organize it. I go to the first picture in that album, and then I go to the share button, right, for that picture. And in that drop-down menu, when I click on share, it'll be send to device. And then it'll have a little, like a TV icon there. So I can pick that. It will see the Apple TV, and then it will send the image to that. Now I can navigate on the phone, you know, however I want to do swiping or whatever, to go from picture to picture, and that'll work nicely. So that's like going via the share icon on both the iPhone and the iPad. Since this is HDMI, when you're using AirPlay, it will send audio as well. Now you have to, you know, test this beforehand. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. But if you have a movie that's already made, for example, that you want to stream to the device, it will do both the pictures and the sound. It will do both the pictures and the sound via AirPlay. You just have to make sure that the movie's already made. At least, I just tested this again before I wrote this podcast, And, you know, Apple will build slideshows on the fly in the Photos app, which is really cool. And it does a really nice job. And it plays great on the device itself. But I had a little bit of a hard time getting those on-the-fly movies to stream to the external LCD TV. The music would come through, but then not the pictures, that kind of thing. I think it's a little bit easier if you just have it be a movie. In other words, you make the movie, so it's a MP4 file or whatever, a QuickTime file, and then that will stream a lot easier than the things that you build on the fly. So you want to play with all of this stuff a little bit ahead of time, right? And, you know, it's very important that regardless of which system that you use, if you have an important event, right, you need to test this ahead of time. You need to test this before the event itself. Even if it's going to be at a hotel or something, at least practice it on your TV, right? And so that you've got, you know, all the local controls down. And then when you get to the event, get there early, find whatever TV that you're going to use, plug in, set it up, and then practice again and make sure that you have time to work out all the bugs before the event happens. Trust me, you have to do this. You have to test it ahead of time. If you just try to do it in real time, you're going to have a hiccup. That's just the way that it works out. You're going to have a hiccup. So make sure that you get there ahead of time. Now, I want to talk a little bit about adjusting the tone and color. Every TV that I've connected to over the last 10 years doing workshops has had a little different look. And it never, at least out of the box, was the look that I was seeing on my MacBook Pro. The color would be different, the tonality would be different, all that kind of stuff. So the way that I do this is that I bring up a picture full screen on the computer so that I have it showing, and then I get it streaming to the TV, and then on the TV with the remote control for the TV, I go to menu. And on that, you'll always find in there somewhere, sometimes you have to dig around a bit because like I said, every brand is a little bit different, but in there somewhere finds picture settings and you want to go to that. Picture settings that we normally have access to on the TV are like brightness, contrast, sharpness, color, tint, color temperature. Sometimes they have modes, picture modes like movie, sports, things like that. All right, so these are all very helpful for fine-tuning the image on the screen and getting as close as possible to what you're seeing on your laptop. I prefer not to go with the modes if I can. I'm really thankful when I get a nice comprehensive set of sliders for color temperature and tint and brightness contrast. That's what I want. And the nice thing about them is that usually as you move those sliders via the remote control for the TV, you get to see the adjustment in real time. So then I go ahead and play with those sliders, trying to get the image on the TV as close as I can to the image on the laptop. The color is almost always off. So, you know, getting that color correct, I usually start with color first. And then I will adjust the brightness and contrast to either open up the shadows a bit or, you know, whatever it happens to need. I usually do that second. And sometimes you have to go back and forth a little bit. So, you know, you do some color adjustments, then you do some tonal adjustments, and you go back to color, back and forth, back and forth. But once you get it, it will usually be darn close, especially on a 4K LCD. And especially if it's a newer TV, you can get it very close. Now, on the older TVs, I've had more difficulty. They're just not as good, honestly. And they don't usually have as many adjusters. But on the newer TVs, let's say over the last few years, if it's like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, I've had pretty good luck getting it the way they want. And remember, I'm showing these images to photographers. So it has had the trial by fire. This method has had the trial by fire. So then once you get those color and tone adjustments dialed in, you should be ready to go. I do look at multiple images before I'm ready to, you know, say that I'm locked and loaded, because, you know, one image might display really nicely on the LCD, and then you go to another image that has a whole different lighting setup, and it might not as well. And sometimes you have to kind of split the difference and find a middle ground. But once you get those locked in, then you should be ready to go. The last thing is just make sure that you have enough power for your device itself that's sending the images to the TV, so that it doesn't, you know, run out of juice in the middle of your presentation. And after that, you're in great shape. So whether you go wirelessly via something like an Apple TV, or you just use a straight HDMI cable, either way can be great. They both have their advantages and disadvantages. The one thing you will always need, regardless, is an extra HDMI cable. But once you have your gear in order and you do your testing, then it is a lot of fun. It is so much fun to gather around a big screen and to share pictures, to share memories, to share art, you know, whatever it happens to be. It's a lot of fun. It makes for great conversation, and people love it. And it's really worth the effort to get it dialed in and to share those images with them. Upgrade your iPhone's weak flash with this adjustable MagSafe light. And this is really cool. This is on TheVerge.com. I have a link to it in the show notes. They have a great picture of it. And I'm going to read to you right now what they say, and then I'll talk a little bit about it. Harlow's Sol 5, and that's S-O-L 5, is a 3-inch extending light that attaches to the MagSafe mount on your iPhone to improve the quality of your photos and selfies. It's available now for $79 or for $159 as part of a travel kit that includes a softbox diffuser to help reduce harsh shadows. The Sol 5 isn't a new idea. When the iPhone 12 debuted with the MagSafe, it opened the floodgates for new accessories, including similar lights that could stay attached to the back of the phone, ready to improve a photo at a moment's notice. What the Sol 5 appears to do better is offer more flexibility and control. And this is why I was attracted to this particular device. The Sol 5's glowing puck is connected to its magnetic mount with a short arm that extends its reach and lets it swivel 180 degrees and angle as needed. This allows the Sol 5 to be used as an indirect light source as well, softening its effect by bouncing it off another nearby surface. But it doesn't need to be stuck on an iPhone. It also can be used as a standalone light source, or even a flashlight that far outperforms what the iPhone's LEDs are capable of. In standard mode, the Sol 5 projects 200 lumens of light, but it also has a temporary boost mode that will increase its output to 360 lumens for 30 seconds. Its brightness can be further adjusted using one of two dial controls. The other allows the Sol 5's color temperature to be adjusted between 2700K, which is warmer, and 6500K, which is cooler. Harlow claims that the Sol 5's built-in rechargeable battery will keep it running at full brightness for 1 hour and 24 minutes, but frequent use of that boost mode will reduce the runtime. The softbox accessory can be purchased outside of the travel kit, which includes a more robust case for everything, for $39. It attaches magnetically to the light to even out its illumination, which Harlow says makes it ideal for portrait, beauty, or close-up shots where softer lighting enhances the subject's appearance. The softbox also includes an additional diffusion panel that can be attached to further soften the Sol 5's output. This is really slick, and when you see the softbox attached, and they have a picture of it in the article, so make sure you go over there. It is a nice disc. It's a nice disc. The softbox has a nice diameter to it. And because you can adjust color temperature as well, I mean, this is a really useful tool that attaches to the phone, but also can be used detached from the phone. And on the, I mean, starting with the iPhone 14, where the macro mode was super enhanced, then you can just have this light on the back of the phone without the diffuser and use it for your close-up photography, use it for just about anything. I think it's a really handy light to have in the camera bag. And that way you can use it for your regular photography. You can use it for your iPhone photography. Take a look at it. And especially since the price is $79 for this, it looks like it's a really good deal as well. So anyway, that is called the Sol 5, S-O-L 5. And you can read all about it on The Verge. And I have a link to it in the show notes. The Tamron 90mm f2.8 DI3 Macro VXD punches way above its weight. And this is a showcase article that is on petapixel.com, and I have a link in the show notes. This is a lens that many of us are very familiar with, and now they have it in the Nikon Z and the Sony E-mounts. All right, let's see what they have to say about it. The 90mm macro prime is an important lens for Tamron. First launched in 1979, it has been a signature focal length for the lens maker, who has released many versions of it during the past 45 years. The latest model, a first for native mirrorless mounts, continues the tradition of strong optical performance and a unique alternative to first-party options. Let's start with the lens itself. The first thing I noticed when taking it out of the box was how incredibly lightweight the lens is. As one of those mirrorless shooters who still uses DSLR lenses, my instinct with a lens of this size is to expect the heft of a 24-70, or worse, my excellent but beefy Zeiss 85mm. But that's not the case here. Quite the opposite, actually. The Sony E-mount version weighs only 630 grams, 1.3 pounds, make it easy to carry around for a full day of shooting. It's hardly noticeable when tucked into a camera bag. Like many of Tamron's recent lenses, the 90mm body is thermally stable plastic, but it has a solid and sturdy feel. It feels great in the hand, which honestly is something I give lots of points for. It features a wide ribbed control ring near the front. It's focused by wire, but I think it's cool that the ring can be adjusted between linear and nonlinear poles using the Tamron lens utility software, and the rotation angle can be expanded to 720 degrees. For a macro lens like this, I'm often focusing to a minimal distance and then changing the camera's position. So while I'm not always making precise pulls, having the ability to adjust the focus's ring function is handy. The front of the lens features a 67mm thread, which has been standard diameter for Tamron lenses lately. The lens hood that comes in the box features a convenient sliding door to adjust spinning filters like a variable ND or a circular polarizer. By the way, I love that feature. I'm seen more often with mirrorless lenses, and I'm a big fan. That said, I rarely use the lens hood. The rest of the lens is pretty straightforward. There's a focus limiter switch and a customizable control button on the side. And near the base is a USB-C port to tether the lens to Tamron lens utility software on a phone or computer. While there is no dedicated AF-MF switch, it was easy enough for me to assign this function to the lens customizable function. Additionally, the focus ring is always responsive even in AF mode and allows for smooth and fine-tuned manual adjustments. So then he goes on to talk about it as a great walk-around lens. And this is something that I've noticed. I've had over the years Tamron 90mm for all sorts of different cameras because they're just so good. That 90mm focal length, even though it's a macro lens, which just really means that the lens barrel comes out farther, right? It just it extends farther. And then, of course, the optics are also designed for both macro work and regular field work. But the thing about the Tamron 90 millimeter is that it's also a great 90 millimeter lens. I mean, I've used various versions of it for portraits over and over again. It's a fantastic portrait lens. You know, it's got a nice fast aperture and it is very sharp and very clean. So that if you just need a 90 millimeter lens, this is a good one, right? This is a good one that also happens to do fantastic macro work. So he goes on and talks about this, doing the 90 millimeter f/2.8 and how he used it out and about for a little street photography and wandering around. And one thing that he said, something I immediately noticed was how tack sharp the images are. They're very sharp. It's the level of detail expected from a 90 millimeter macro. Still, it speaks to the beauty of this newly redesigned version. It can truly handle a high megapixel modern mirrorless sensor. I still believe that there's plenty of life left in adapting DSLR lenses to mirrorless. However, when using a lens like this that Tamron designed to take full advantage of, say, the 61 megapixels of the Sony A7R-V, the detail it can resolve is astounding. That's pretty high praise for this lens. And then there are a lot of pictures out in the street that really seems to back that up. And then he goes on to talk about vignette is well controlled. The bokeh is quite pleasant when wide open, you know, all that sort of stuff. So if you want to know those details, I would definitely go to the article itself. Now, I went over to B&H and I looked up the lens. New release, but it's in stock for both the Sony E mount and the Nikon Z mount. Both mounts are $699. $699 for this lens. So I'm very excited about it. I think I would like to get my hands on one and test it. And I'm going to see what I can get out of B&H here so that I can borrow one for a bit. And if I do, I will definitely do a follow-up on this. But right now, this looks like a winner to me. So happy that Tamron has brought this lens out for mirrorless bodies. And I hope we see it in more mounts as well. Okay, let's take care of a little Virtual Camera Club news. A few things. First, I want to start out with our Inner Circle members. And obviously, a big thanks to those folks for supporting this podcast. I have been getting notes and comments from Inner Circle members about the upcoming workshop season. Now that I have finished the last workshop, we wrapped up the Safari West Sonoma workshop on Saturday, just the other day. Now that I have that wrapped up, I'm going to be able to wrap up the 2025 workshop season. And the way this is going to play out is that Inner Circle members, you will be notified on Friday about the upcoming workshop season. I'll post that notification both on the Patreon site for Inner Circle members, and I'll also post it on our Inner Circle space, right? So that'll be on Friday. You'll get notification. And you'll also have a link that you can use to go to the workshop page. Then on Tuesday for the podcast, then I'm going to release the workshop schedule to the general public. You know, anyone who listens to the podcast, I'll do a blog post about it and all that stuff. So Inner Circle folks, you will have from Friday to Tuesday to review the schedule and to reserve a spot if you wish, and then a general public, you'll have from next Tuesday on the next podcast. I'll go over the entire workshop season on next week's show, and that will be the debut of it for the general public. I'm really excited about it. As you know, I've worked really hard on kind of deciding what I'm going to do, but we have new online workshops. We're doing new topics this year. I think the topics we've been working with are fantastic, but I'm going to give them a rest for a season and we'll do new topics this year. And then the physical workshops will be a combination of old and new, but even the ones that we've done before, it's been a while since we've done them. So for a lot of folks, everything will be fresh. I'm truly excited about it. So stay tuned. And Inner Circle members, thank you so much for your support. This is one of the perks that I like to share with you as a thank you for your support. If you want to become an Inner Circle member before all of this happens later this week, all you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story, and you can sign up there, and your benefits, including discounts for all the workshops, kick in immediately. And a big thanks to our Inner Circle members for supporting this show. And finally, I'd like to give a huge shout out to our friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the Digital Story. And we talked a fair amount about printing during the workshop. And one thing that stood out to me during our conversations was that, you know, we're so used to when we print of kind of always printing on the same kind of paper. It's like the paper that comes with the printer. It's the paper that you always get, you know, with a kid or whatever. And it's always that kind of flimsy paper that has a, you know, very glossy surface on it. And it always kind of feels the same way. You know, it feels a little plasticky and, you know, all that. Not very satisfying to hold. The images look nice on it, but just in terms of, you know, tactile qualities, leaves a lot to be desired. And one of the talking points we had during the workshop was, you know, folks getting some different types of paper that were completely opposite of this. You know, paper that was thicker, paper that had a really nice feel to it, paper that had different surfaces on it. And they're just going, man, I didn't even know that printing paper was made like this. I didn't even know this stuff was available. And it is so exciting, and it just sort of changes the whole game, and it opens up new possibilities for how you use that paper. If you think that all printing paper is the same and feels that like that thin plasticky stuff, then you need to nose around on the Red River Paper site and start looking at some of these other papers, and they will help you. They talk about the different surfaces and so forth, and they talk about the different thicknesses and how the papers are made. Get something that feels good as well as looks good, and that's what Red River Paper can do for you. Get on there. All you have to do is just go to the Digital Story, click on the Red River Paper tile that runs on all the pages, nose around a bit, read a little bit about, get yourself some real paper, right? And then use the discount code that we have on our landing page. When you click on the tile, get free shipping and find out that printing can be not only visually stimulating, but it can also have a great tactile sensation as well. And a big thanks to Red River Paper for sponsoring our podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show working on the workshops for next week. Until then, get out there, take some pictures, stay safe. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.